Welcome. This session is focused on sharing and question and answers regarding the session I did with Rosa last week. And so I'd like to open it up to anybody who has any questions, sharing of your own experiences, any response that you have in relation to the work I did with Rosa.
During Rosa's session, I saw you, Robert, making choices about where to place the attention. And I notice in my own life right now, there's so much going on that when I try to do inner work, one thing opens the next thing, and I don't know which direction to go. And so in Rosa's session, as an observer, I saw, you know, there were times that you could have stayed in her present experience with her present family, or there were times when you could have gone to her experience as a child. So there were a lot of choices. And when I'm working with myself, I don't feel confident in how to make those choices.
I'm wondering if the question is, when I'm doing my own inner work, I don't always know where to attend to because there's so many things that pop up. What would I do? What would I recommend as far as what to attend to? And well, the first thing is one at a time. If there's four choices, pick one rather than not choosing one or trying to attend to all of them. So, and then the other criteria that I would tend to go with is which one seems to have the most life, the most energy, and then go towards that one. The other ones are there. They might or might not go away, but, you know, but to attend to the one that has the most energy. But pick one and then go deeply into it. And beyond that, it's hard to predict what will happen, what will arise in your inner experience. And a sense of trusting it. Just trusting that this is where your awareness is, where your attention is. Going into your inner experience and trusting whatever arises from there. So trust for me is a really important element as well.
So when you're doing the internal by yourself, is there a delineation between the head process and the feeling process? Because I noticed you moved me in that way.
Yes, it's part of the tracking process. Is I want to be able to identify and track what part of my system is operating. Am I in thinking? I want to recognize I'm in thinking. Am I in my vulnerability? I want to be able to acknowledge that and go with that. Because unless I do, I'm going to believe in my thoughts that are trying to protect me from something, and rather than simply recognize it as a thought and then go into my vulnerability. So keeping track of the thinking mechanism, the defensive and protective mechanism, is really important.
I was very aware, Rosa, of your of how you were holding your body when you first started, and then at the end of it, your face just looked to me more relaxed, and how you were holding yourself just energetically felt very different to me. And so I was wondering, one, what your experience was as the session unfolded in terms of in your body, and if you were aware of that. And then I had a question for Robert.
Okay.
Well, when I first got up here, I mean, it was really scary to bring something you're very vulnerable of, you know, in public. And I was like hyper aware of what I was doing with my body, because I probably wanted to sit in a really tight position. I probably, if I could think of like, I just think of a need of like, there was a lot more protection going on in the beginning, and at the end there wasn't. I felt a lot of safety.
Also, Robert, just wondering with you, I think of the word resonance, and as I watched you, and I've also worked with you, that sense of it appears as though you sort of lock in with, you were locking in with Rosa in some sense, and I, resonance is the word that I was asking myself, is that what was happening? That when you talk about tracking, that how do you know when you're on track? And wondering if that is, feel like resonance is part of that.
Yes, yes. Now resonance is definitely a part of the quality of presence and being with Rosa or whomever I'm working with. But it's also a recognition that it's a cognitive recognition. That it's not necessarily a resonance, it's on a feeling level. Mm-hmm. So I can sense into the vulnerability or sense when she's talking about a memory and not feeling something presently. I'm trying to bring, guide the person into feeling the present moment. But I also am able to cognitively recognize when there's a thought. So I wouldn't, strictly speaking, call that resonance, but I would call it a cognitive acknowledgement of thinking. So I just wanted to add that part of it. Yeah.
So that's a broad awareness. Within that is sensing the resonant quality that's arising between you, plus whatever cognitive awareness about you have about your own training and about your own experience, and holding that all simultaneously?
Yes. Yeah.
Rosa, I just want to thank you for being willing to get up. I always feel a lot of gratitude when I watch somebody else work, whether it's in my own practice group or here, because it's just universal what we go through. I really can understand exactly. I mean, I see it in myself. It might show up in a slightly different way, but I can see it in myself, you know, a lot of the things that you say. So I feel like I'm getting worked with too when you go through this process.
Especially when you were kind of visiting the young part, I just had this image an experience I had just the previous morning, or I should say the previous day. I had forgotten the shoes that I wanted to wear. And so I stopped by my sister's house and just for a few minutes, and my 1-year-old niece came up to me, and she's been walking for maybe a month or two, and she's not using words yet, but she's definitely using, you know, expressive sounds, and just kind of the pure joy that I was getting from her, and kind of you know, nothing defended, or just, you know, kind of a greeting of life, like hi. And so I don't know, there's just something in that that I find precious, and for some reason that's was in me a lot during your time. So anyway, I just wanted to share that.
Okay, thank you. I like that. Just make a comment on that. we talk about parts, the young part for me, it's that's an aspect of our inner being, our inner experiencing. It's part of the multidimensional aspect of who we are, you know. And so I think it's really important to be able to recognize that these qualities, like innocence, aren't necessarily just from our young self, you know, our child part. For me, it's part of who we are. It's part of our nature. So for me, one of the aspects of our essence is that we are innocent. There's a quality of innocence in our being. And it's more evident in children, I think, than it is in adults, because we've kind of had it pounded and conditioned out of us, you know. And so it's hard to reclaim our innocence, that fresh, pure, open, kind of really trusting relationship with life that I believe that we all long for. So just wanted to comment on what that stimulated in me.
Thanks, Robert.
Yeah.
I was remembering in the introduction you were talking about, I'm trying to remember, it was something about there being three different levels. So with my example, can you define that you saw three different levels?
Or? Yeah, the three levels are essence.
Okay.
And I certainly got that in your part of your experience. I don't remember exactly where you were, is that you were in this place of just really open freedom of what you were so longing for. That for me was your essence coming through.
Okay.
And then there's the zone of vulnerability.
Okay.
Is that part of...
So would that be the fear?
And that would be the... Well, the there's vulnerable fear that okay. goes with the vulnerability, and there's frozen fear that goes with protection and defensiveness.
Okay.
So there was a part of the fear, the loneliness. Much of what you were experiencing from the young part is really part of the vulnerability that I was hearing. And then, of course, then there's the protective and defensive part of you that came into play in various times. When you were expressing like the evaluative part of your mind that was questioning trust, for example.
Right.
And anytime you were in the primary evaluation and thinking mode is when you were in that, as I define it, that defensive and protective mode. So those are the three dimensions.
Is it sort of like the core is the essence and the other?
I think that's a metaphor, one way to describe it, is the essence can be seen as the core. And then the layers on top of that through life experience are vulnerable self. And then the outer sort of layer that we present ourself in relation to life is this protective part that becomes a kind of a filter through which we experience life.
And so this is about being aware of the three levels.
Yes.
There are three, or I mean, according to what we're studying here.
Yeah.
And then being like with all three.
Yes. Being with all three.
Yes. Yes. And allowing them to speak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. There's a little bit more in the principle, but that's essentially what it is you creating the space for them, allowing them. In particular, what's important is when we're in this defensive protective mode, there's a particular way of being with each of the three.
Mm.
So being with the protective and defensive is I have a choice. I can be with my protection and defensive, which means I don't enact it. When I enact it, I'm going to withdraw or I'm going to judge in aggression.
Mm-hmm.
That's enacting the protection. I'm acting from it. Or that's a form of doing the defensive and protective part of me. Or what this work calls for is to be with it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm being with it. And that means I self-responsibly recognize that I'm in the evaluative thinking protective mode, and by being with it I create a different space in which it can transform. So my judgments can transform into the vulnerability and the deeper longings. So that's the way in which I am with it is really critical.
Would you speak a little bit more about distinguishing vulnerable fear from frozen fear?
Good question. For me, it's been really important that in my own experience, I've recognized that when I'm in what I call frozen fear, it's actually a fear that I get locked into. I can't move. It's just there. I get lost in my fear. Have any of you experienced that? Yes, a lot of heads. And that actually is more tied to what I call chronic fear. It's kind of a, more than just fear, it's a condition. It's like an ongoing condition that I identify with. But it is a quality of fear. It's a kind of tension. And it's frozen in that it's immovable. It doesn't seem to be able to move a whole lot. I'm just, when I tune in to the feeling level of it, it feels like I'm constantly anxious or fearful. And I distinguish chronic fear from acute fear. Or something happens in life, in an episode or an event, and in an acute manner, there's a moment or moments of fear that are stimulated. But when I bring a compassionate, open awareness to my frozen fear, and I really create a space of caring and compassion in that, then the frozen fear begins to soften and dissolve. Then it becomes a softer fear, a vulnerable fear. And this is the place where there's an opportunity to actually enter into an experience that's moving, allowing the vulnerable fear to be felt. And the movement from vulnerable fear into my longing is much more enabled when I create a spacious, compassionate awareness in relationship to the fear.
If I could just follow up on that question, I'm not sure about this, but I'm experiencing fear in a way that I don't ever remember experiencing it before. And it seems like something that I would call existential fear in some way, that it doesn't seem to have any source. It seems to come out of nowhere, that it's just about my existence itself that is unknown. I'm living in the unknown. And I recognize that it's really unknown and anything can happen. And sometimes that stimulates this fear that has that quality to it. I'm just wondering, would you make any distinction between that kind of fear and fear that seems to come from a particular experience, like somebody doing something, somebody hitting you or chasing you or some other kind of experience?
I would. It sounds as though the distinction that you made is akin to or similar to the distinction I made between acute fear and chronic fear. For me, chronic fear is more existential. I'm fearful because I'm alive, because I exist. There's just a chronic sense of anxiety and tension that I have in relationship, not to any situation, but to being alive. I don't know if anybody's ever experienced that. You wake up fearful. You wake up and you're scared. There's nothing that's happened. I'm just scared. And there's nothing logical or rational about it, and being able to point to anything that has stimulated this fear. It's just the sense of, and I like your naming of it because that's how it fits for me, it's existential fear. And this, for me, in my understanding, goes to the deep identity with separation. One, I don't know if you're familiar with the sutras, Patanjali sutras from the Vedas, ancient Hindu teaching. The Vedas are the source of Hindu teaching, but it doesn't matter. The quote is, wherever there is another, there is fear. So there's a sense of deep existential fear. If we allow ourselves to penetrate into that consciousness, wherever there is separation, there is fear. And we might feel it in varying degrees. You might feel it with a level of intensity, or maybe feel it as a kind of a low level kind of chronic buzz of my existence and not even recognize it, because like a fish in water, we don't recognize because we think this is just the way it is. This is life. And not even recognize it as fear. But I'm hearing what you said in your experiences, there's a level of intensity with it, which the part of my mind goes to celebrate that. Because in my view, there's an opportunity then, tremendous opportunity to be with and enter into the roots of this existential fear in you. There's a tremendous opportunity there.
Yeah, that's what it seems like, because it seems to arise out of the loss of the illusion that I had about what I thought the world was, that I felt safe in, that I didn't know what's going on, and now I recognize it's a recognition I don't really know what's going on.
Beautiful.
Here.
Yeah.
And then that's where the fear comes from.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. I love hearing that. You said loss of the illusion, which is a disillusionment.
Yeah.
So what's disillusion was the illusion is gone, meaning truth isn't there. The illusion is gone.
Right.
The matter is then your mind, I'm interpreting that your mind thinks that it knows the truth, and so it's not there and it feels anxious.
Right. I'm still, there's a place in my mind that's still looking for something to grab a hold of. You know?
The way I see that, it's the mind looking for something to grab a hold of. And so what actually dies, I think, is the mind. The being can't die. So, but maybe in this sort of struggle, your mind is grasping. I think that's what's going on.
Yeah.
And we'll, that's right. And the thing is, for me, the mind will never find out, will never learn or understand the truth. And you've got a choice. You might be relegated into a life of existential fear that will never go away. As long as you keep empowering the mind to think that it can never know anything. Or you can actually allow yourself to delve into the mystery of the unknown. Bypass the mind. And just really surrender to the freedom of this complete mystery.
Yeah.
Which is an incredible practice all by itself.
Rosa, can I ask you a question? So I'm guessing that in the beginning of your work, you were kind of mad at yourself for acting out in the ways that you did. I'm wondering, were you able in your work to bring compassion to that part of you that is acting out, acting in ways that you didn't like?
Yeah, I think that Robert helped really unravel the motivation for, instead of going right to the thought, like, oh, I shouldn't have done that, it went to the motivations. And then by being with that and then recognizing the essence and being with the essence, that just kind of melted everything. And so it just was a natural occurrence that there's a lot more compassion. So I'd be interested to see what happens next.
Thank you.
I would like to add to that question, not to add to it, but to acknowledge the validity of, I'd be interested to see what happens next. But I would be additionally interested in seeing, what will you do next?
Yeah.
What quality of care will you bring? Because there's agency there.
Yeah.
And this is maybe my interpretation, that what happens is can be seen as almost a passive. Where's your agency? Is it going to happen, or will you have agency in terms of you actually, quote unquote, doing something?
Yeah.
Will you be able to bring self-care to your own inner experience?
Yeah.
Just wanted to reframe that for you and see how that is for you in hearing
well,
me say that.
You saying that, it makes it much more of a me taking action and being yeah. responsible for my life
yeah.
rather than life happening and let's just see what happens.
Yeah.
It's like, no, if I want change,
yeah.
what am I going to do to catalyst change?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I want to even add a little bit more. I'm just... to the language is very important to me. You say,
okay.
Taking action for me is the quality of inner action is really different than outer action. I know you know that, but I'm just mm-hmm. naming it.
Yeah.
And inner action is, can I bring a quality of being, which is can be a form of inner action. Can I bring a quality of being, which is my attending to it, so it can be a way of inner doing, so to speak. Just naming that for me is important when I attend to my own experience.
And what I'm realizing while you were just talking is I just projected into this, if that happens again and then I do the same reaction, I could see myself getting even more upset with myself. Well, you just spent all that time with Robert and you're still doing it?
Yeah.
You know, and so then when I think of that, like I really sit with that, I go, wow, I really do want to take a responsible, conscious, mm-hmm. Request of myself to do it differently.
Yeah. Okay. Beautiful.
Right. But I keep going back to this, and maybe it's my cognitive understanding of what we're doing, and that I've been studying a lot about the brain lately and the way the brain functions. And what's interesting to me is that's not really a consideration here. Because I could go into, oh, well, that's the amygdala,
yeah,
and there's this question of what are you doing? My amygdala is, you know, ignited, yeah, and yeah, there's nowhere to go, and yeah, does NVC empathy work? I mean, I've been in that kind of discussion. And it seems like this is like going, like we're not even going there.
Yeah.
We're just going with what is your internal experience, yeah, and what are you going to do when these things happen?
Exactly.
Is that correct?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
And it's not to say that whatever information in the neurosciences, neurobiology, interpersonal neurobiology is taking place is not valid in its own domain.
Yeah.
But in its own domain, it has its usefulness and perhaps application to inner experience. I don't have a primary focus on that.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, I think even in my understanding of how the brain works in neurobiology, when change actually takes place because of how we attend, mm-hmm, how we focus our awareness, not because of some understanding I've read from the scientific research. That might help a little bit.
Yeah.
But it helps only because it shifts the cognition that is an inner agency with respect to my inner experience. So in that sense, I agree with you. That kind of intellectual understanding that reflects real science can or can be relevant, but the real relevance is in attending to my own inner awareness and inner experiencing. I am doing something.
And I realize that if I think scientifically, then I might think something like, oh, if I keep strengthening the muscle, you know, that is resilient, then I'll start to judge myself when I'm not resilient. Versus this is just, I'm just going to be with what is, which is a lot more loving.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.